You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, 1A honors Tina Turner's fiercely graceful life and music, and they're inviting your memories as well. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, retirement planning can be complicated and confusing, and a new survey finds that many people's expectations don't match up with the realities of retirement. That survey comes from the Employee Benefit Research Institute. It included over 1,000 retirees and over 1,000 people who are still in the workforce. One finding, over 70% of current workers expect to make money by working after retirement. But hang on, only about 30% of retirees actually bring home money from employment. Workers also had different expectations about when they would retire and how much of a role Social Security would play in their post-retirement finances. Our next guest follows retirement issues and working later in life, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you recently retired, did everything go according to plan, or did you retire maybe earlier than you wanted to? Did you want to work after retiring? If so, are you working? And if you're looking ahead at retirement, however far down the road, what are some of the biggest things that you find confusing, hard to predict, hard to get started on even thinking about? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Carrie Hannon is a career transition, retirement, and personal finance expert. She's a senior columnist at Yahoo Finance. Her latest book is called In Control at 50 Plus, How to Succeed in the New World of Work. Carrie, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, it's fantastic to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
One of the most striking things about that survey is that stat I mentioned. Most people, by a fair margin, think, yeah, I'm going to keep making money by working after retirement. A minority of people actually do that after they retire. What do you make of that big difference?
Yeah, you know, I think that there is this idea that we're going to be able to continue working. And what happens is simply life gets in the way, right? I mean, there are a couple of things that can happen. It's normally a health issue or some sort of disability that may keep you out of the workplace. And it can also simply be ageism. You know, it's deeply embedded in our culture, in the workplace, and it might be just a bit harder to get back to work or continue to work than people imagine it's going to be. So there are things you can do to make it more possible for you, but there really is a huge gap here in what people expect to do in earning money in retirement and what actually happens.
Now, for that person who is trying to figure out what their post-retirement finances might look like, what would you say to them if they said, yeah, a good portion of my retirement is going to come from working after retirement? How might they adjust their thoughts based on this survey?
Well, you know, the point is you need to, if you think that's what you want to do, you have to do all of those things to make this a possibility for you. You need to start thinking in advance, line some things up. And these can be contract work opportunities. So it doesn't mean pedal to the metal as it was before, but try to line some things up. Make sure that your skills are relevant, that you have skills that are up to date, because no employer is going to take you on if they have to train you to do a new job. So you need to make sure you're current in the skills that you have and that have a real, you know, take the time ahead of time to scope out what might be possible for you. And I do think an important thing to remember is remote work coming out of the pandemic. Remote work took off. It's here to stay. Yes, employers love hybrid situations these days, but for retired workers or someone who has a health issue that doesn't want to deal with the commute anywhere, remote jobs are really a great way to go. And you don't have to work for somebody in your town. These are global opportunities.
I want to stay on this subject before we move on to other parts of this survey, because you've written a couple, since this piece came out, you've written a couple of things related to it. And maybe some good news here. Another survey of employers says it looks like over time they're getting more willing to hire and keep older workers. What do we see there?
Oh, I so love that. Yeah, thank you for noting that. Transamerica Institute came out with a recent survey that said that, hey, you know, employers are finally saying that, yeah, we are, you know, giving a great deal of consideration to workers over 50 or more considerable attention to them, which is something they didn't say in the past. They also noted that they are offering more workplace training programs to help retain their older workers, and other situations looking for more flexible opportunities. These are all great things that employers, I mean, I got to tell you, you know this as well as many of the listeners out there, is that it's a reality that employers need to keep older workers on the job, whether it's on a part-time basis, on a flexible basis, because sheer demographics, there are just not as many younger workers coming up through the system because of the fallout in fertility rates, which started a long time ago. It's a global issue, but in order to keep their workforce, they need to hang on to these older workers.
And another piece, just scrolling through your list, Carrie, gives us tons of ideas for topics here. You wrote about, again, for these seniors, either older workers looking to change careers or maybe thinking about that post-retirement job, adult education programs can be a gold mine. What is out there?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of this. And it's so important that people, as I mentioned at the top, you know, you have to keep your skills relevant and up to date for whatever the position you're looking to do is. And coming out of the pandemic, virtual learning opportunities absolutely exploded. I mean, we're not talking, you don't have to go get a degree or spend a ton of money. You can really just cherry pick. I want to do this particular skill. And if you go online, there's from the big universities down to, you know, just smaller programs, you can find programs that you can do virtually as well as go in person. You know, the community college system still offers a great deal, but the opportunities that both universities, colleges, and then some other more nuanced groups are starting to offer classes really aimed at the older student. And again, let me tell you, this goes back to demographics, because they are seeing a shortage of this, the younger people coming up in traditional, that 4-year university experience, perhaps, or longer with a master's or a PhD or what have you. But they need to build out lifelong learning, or long life learning, as we like to call it, because there is this longevity. People are living longer for the most part. And so say, you know, it's not just one and done, 4 years of college and you're out. They need to build systems where people are learning throughout their lifespan. And this is what we're seeing starting to happen. And I really encourage workers who are interested in staying in the workplace in some way, earning an income, to, you know, have some financial security as you age. This is a wonderful thing to do for yourself. But take a look around, and they can look at my article, but there's plenty of resources out there.
Talking to Carrie Hannon, columnist at Yahoo Finance, author of books including In Control at 50 Plus, How to Succeed in the New World of Work. We're talking about a recent survey that shows we have a lot of expectations about retirement that don't match up with the realities for retired people when it comes to things like working, timing of retirement, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you retire earlier than planned? Have you worked after retirement? What did it take to get a job post-retirement? Join in with your experiences or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with finance columnist Carrie Hannon about retirement and why our expectations don't always match up with reality. Recent survey found a big gap between what people thought would happen in retirement, the timing of retirement, if they'd keep working, and what actually happens. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Russell is with us in Taylor County. Russell, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I was listening to the program just now, and I work for a delivery service that owns white trucks, not brown ones, and I'm 75 years old. I had 30 years in one of the branches of the service, and I'm a retired officer, and I taught school for a long time, and I just can't emphasize hard enough that you have to stay engaged with this life, and I don't mean just a little bit. You have to stay fully engaged with the life. And that's my way of doing it. I'm outside. It's a beautiful day in northern Wisconsin. I've had a great time driving, just as I always do. It's a lot of physical work. I make a little bit of walking around money. It's a great way to go.
And Russell, you're in pretty good shape, it sounds like, at 75.
Well, you know, for a long time I wasn't.
Yeah.
I was just, you know, kind of doing jobs that were easy to do. And so I deliberately took a job that's not easy physically to do.
Interesting. Russell, thanks for that call and sharing your experience. More power to you. Carrie, great for Russell. What should other people be thinking about if they want to work at 75? Yeah.
Oh, Rob, thanks. You know, I just want to chime in with Russell. Way to go. Because that's another point to make. It's not all about the money. Yes, that's nice to have, as he called it, walking around money, or maybe even more. But what continuing to work in retirement years is also part of socialization. It's about having a reason to get up in the morning, out doing something physical and engaged in the world. And that is, that mental benefit is so important to remember. And I do think that that work, people get caught up in it being sort of a four-letter word, when in fact, it is really something that can be super positive in all kinds of parts of our lives.
Russell, thanks so much for calling in. John joins us now in Duluth. John, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, the main point I would make was, it would be, it's great to pursue the things that you were interested in but didn't have time when you were working, or felt guilty doing them because you should actually be doing your work-related stuff. But what I would recommend to people is, before you retire, like let's say a year before you retire, and it might be hard to do, but calculate what your budget is going to be, what your actual retirement income is going to be, and then live according to that budget for a year. And then the money that you don't spend, then you can put that away in a savings account. So when you retire, you know, I just had a furnace bill on expensively for $711. When I was working, well, okay, I can do that. You know, when you retire, that's a big chunk out of a retirement check. So that was the hardest thing, is you retire and you're used to having twice the income and you don't have that anymore.
John, thanks for calling. I think a lot of important steps there, Carrie. First of all, talking the idea of calculating how much money am I going to make after I retire?
Yes, John, thank you for bringing that up for Rob and me, because that's a point. So many people don't take the time to run their numbers. It's, you know, it sounds kind of daunting. They'll get to it eventually, or they don't want to even think about it. But if you can plan ahead and at least get a rough, there are lots of retirement calculators online. You can maybe work with a financial advisor or whatever it is that's going to work for you. But if you can take that time and really focus on what's it going to look like, do that budget, as you said, John. It really can make a huge difference in how people really navigate this next chapter in their lives.
John, thanks a lot for sharing that. I appreciate it. Getting back to the survey we started with, here's another interesting misconception. People underestimate the role of Social Security income as they anticipate retirement. What did we learn there?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the EBRI study showed that only a third of workers, 33%, expect Social Security will be a major source of income in retirement. But guess what? The majority of retirees say it is. So there is this disconnect. They're not fit doing that budget, running those expected numbers. And frankly, the Social Security Administration, you can go right online now at their website, and there are ways that you can get a good bead on what your monthly check is likely to be. And then you work from there and find out how big a source of income is that going to be. Do you need to bring in additional income from some sort of work after retirement? And some of those things you and I discussed earlier, Rob.
Let's go back to our callers now. Chloe is with us in Clinton. Chloe, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I was a reluctant retiree. I did not want to retire, but at the age of 72, I felt compelled because of my required minimum distributions for my investments going back to the government if I continued working. But I needed the intellectual stimulation and socialization of working with other people. So I now volunteer more than 40 hours a week.
Wow.
With our Rotary Club and the SCORE organization as a mentor, and I couldn't be happier.
And Chloe, I got to ask, what was your job that you were so happy to stick with?
I did international project management for a firm that manufactures hematology instruments.
Wow. Chloe, thanks so much for sharing that. Carrie, what do you think of Chloe's story?
Chloe, way to go again. I mean, I love this idea of working and making it, you know, working not for pay necessarily, but making an impact, giving back. And I mean, as a project manager, I can be quite assured that you can do almost anything you're asked to do in an organization. And so this is really important for people to remember, because you are also getting those benefits of engaging with the world, you know, getting out of your head and into the world and having that socialization, that mental stimulation, all those great things. But at the same time, you're giving back. So I think this is an example that a lot of people should consider.
Chloe, thanks for sharing that. And Carrie, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Oh, Rob, thank you. Thank you.
That was Carrie Hannon, career transition, retirement, and personal finance expert. She's a senior columnist at Yahoo Finance. Her latest book is In Control at 50 Plus, How to Succeed in the New World of Work. By the way, the article that Carrie wrote that triggered this conversation, we've got it linked over at WPR.org/Central Time, looking at retirement, why our expectations don't always match up with reality. You can keep sharing your story of how retirement worked for you or how you're hoping it's going to work for you. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Did things work out differently for you? In a good way, in a bad way, a little of both. Love to hear your story. Again, you could email ideas@WPR.org. In February, a gunman opened fire on the campus of Michigan State University. It was the latest case of a mass shooting on a college campus. As political debates about how to stop mass shootings have stalled, Rich Kramer reports it's up to law enforcement agencies like UW-Madison's police department to teach officers how to stop them once the shooting starts.
You can feel the blast from the 9mm blank as it reverberates down the concrete hallways of UW-Madison's vacant Biotron laboratory. A light cloud of dust falls from ceiling tiles as the sound of hurried footsteps gets louder.
Where did they come from?
A UWPD officer is wearing a plastic face mask and carrying a training pistol that fires high-powered paintballs. He rushes toward the shots, passing colleagues covered in fake blood lying on the ground. Inside a room, another officer, posing as a mass shooter, is waiting. In the melee, a number of UWPD officers and the faux shooter are hit by paint rounds that leave weeping red welts. The April training scenarios are loosely based on past mass shootings at businesses, schools, and universities. There's no single definition of a mass shooting, but by one measure, there have been more than 200 of them this year. The frequency of shootings means simulations like these have become a routine part of law enforcement training. UWPD Lieutenant Jeff Ellis says the department studies mass shootings that happened in Wisconsin and beyond. It's a grim reality, but he says officers have to be ready if it happens at UW-Madison.
I mean, we need to be our best that day. And I think when we do look at it, yeah, it'd be great if this wasn't as prevalent as it is. You know, I think that's why we study as hard as we do. That's why we train the way we do.
An awareness that shootings can happen on campus affects student life, too. At UW-Madison's Memorial Union Terrace on the shore of Lake Mendota, PhD candidate Rashank Jambur sits on the grass with friends. The students here are unaware of the training on the other side of campus. Mass shootings didn't happen during his childhood in India, and Jambur says he never thought about them.
Once you come here and once you start hearing about it, that's when you start, you know, feeling a little scared.
Freshman Mary Bear of Minneapolis and Simona Lottasina of Chicago had a very different childhood. They trained on how to respond to mass shootings in school. Bear says they were called Code Red drills in Minnesota.
I've always sort of been told that it's not an if, it's more just of a when it's going to be something that I have to deal with. And so every time that I'm sort of in a large space, I'm always kind of told to find the nearest exit and sort of just have a mental preparation of how I was going to deal with something like this.
Lottasina's high school had metal detectors at the doors. On normal days, she says one out of 20 students would be asked to walk through. If there was a threat, she says they'd all be screened and the line would round the block.
So that was definitely a really scary situation.
Francie Crapo Hobson is a professor of school psychology at the University of Colorado, Denver. She says the stress from repetitive stories about school shootings can take a mental toll on young people, but research shows that well-designed drills with prior education can boost perceptions of safety.
It should never be a surprise, because otherwise people believe there's a real-life threat
And that is terrifying.
Former Madison Middle School teacher Abigail Sweats says pre-planned drills she and her students were part of were still terrifying.
It was always in the back of my mind that if this were real, I would put my body on the line for my students.
Sweats, who now works in the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, says she favors more restrictions on gun ownership. But in the absence of new laws, she says it's often up to schools and students to prevent deaths. Back at the UWPD simulation, officers are focused on how to respond effectively. Lieutenant and instructor Adam Boardman says it's up to them to stop the shooting.
I'm not going to stand outside and wait for people to get shot. I'm the one with the gear and the training and the firearms. It's my job, even if I, in the back of my head, don't want to do that, right? You don't want to go in there, but that's what you have to do.
It's one way that law enforcement training for mass shootings has changed over time. The mantra during their training is, stop the killing, then stop the dying. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at the long-term impact of childhood trauma and adverse childhood experiences from the lens of primate research, find out what some of our animal cousins do to recover from trauma, and then back to the human world and look at efforts to deal with adverse childhood experiences here in Wisconsin. Also tomorrow, housing costs are high in many Wisconsin communities, big and small. We'll check out new efforts to bring those costs down, including a conversation with a state lawmaker, part of a package of bills aimed at dealing with the high costs of housing here in Wisconsin. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. This one sounds pretty interesting to me. From cumin and yogurt to raisins and cheese, we'll find out why some flavors work together, sometimes in surprising ways. We'll talk to the author of a book called The Flavor Thesaurus about ways to combine familiar flavors in unfamiliar ways. If you have a favorite unusual combination that works for you, or one you've encountered that doesn't work for you, tell us about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll explore the made-up words and phrases that we use with our family and friend groups and what they can tell us about our relationships. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, find out why Wisconsin has the second highest rate in the nation of prisoners who are incarcerated for a crime they committed when they were 17 years old or younger. First, does it sometimes feel like your family or maybe your close group of friends speaks its own language? If so, you're not alone. What you're speaking is called a familect. That's a unique set of words or phrases created and used within a tight-knit social group. These private languages, these family dialects, can tell us a lot about their speakers and their relationships with one another. The term familylect was originally coined for multilingual families, but the term has since evolved. Now it could apply to the unique language of any close social unit. It's a topic of interest to word nerds like maybe you and certainly our next guest. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Okay, do you have some of these words and phrases that are unique maybe in your family or maybe your group of friends or a workplace? How did that word or those phrases come about? What's the story behind it? Was it the result of a mispronunciation, a funny circumstance, a strange interaction? Call in now with yours at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Martha Barnett is a co-host of Away with Words, a public radio show about language. You can hear the show on the Ideas Network on Sunday mornings at 9. She's the author of several books on word origins. Martha, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Great to be here.
Well, can you tell us a little more about what a familect, apart from being hard to say, a familect actually is?
Yeah, you have it right. A familect is like a dialect. A dialect is a regional variety of language that's distinguished by its vocabulary, pronunciation, and grammar. And a familect is that same kind of thing, only much smaller. It's a private slang. It's that unique vocabulary of words and phrases, and sometimes different pronunciations that belong to a family or, as you said, a close-knit social group. And what makes them so much fun, in part, is that they're often completely unintelligible to somebody outside your family. And that's one of the things that's really great about these Familecs is it's all about connection. They help us feel like family. It gives us a sense of intimacy. You know, it's like any kind of slang that's shared by a group reinforces the idea that, hey, we all belong to each other. We understand each other. We have a history. And, you know, sometimes these words and phrases will stick with us for life. They're so special and so uniquely identified with dad or grandma that sometimes that word or phrase is going to end up in that person's obituary. We see that a lot.
And you have a great data set among Way With Words listeners. Do you hear a lot of these examples of unique words and phrases from families?
Oh my gosh, all the time. It's so much fun. A lot of times they arise spontaneously. It's what a linguist referred to as the effervescing of language. Like from childhood misunderstandings or mispronunciations. Maybe your toddler couldn't say the word phone. And to this day, everybody in the household says, hey, hand me my phone. You know, or my little brother couldn't pronounce my name Martha. And so for years and years and years after he was, you know, a public speaker, I was still Mimi in the family. Or, you know, little kids will come up with, you know, barsh barrels for marshmallows or hiccup truck. We heard that one from a listener. And sometimes, you know, even within a couple, you'll have your own language. You know, you'll be on your own planet linguistically. And maybe you were texting back and forth and autocorrect changed your message to something hilarious. And you just keep using that word.
One of my favorites in my family is when our kids were littler, we went to this park a little further away. It had a seesaw shaped like a hot dog. So, of course, we called it Hot Dog Seesaw Park. Well, the seesaw broke. They took it out. And we still call it Hot Dog Seesaw Park years later. And it would have absolutely no meaning to anyone, even if they played in that park every day.
Yeah, that's a great one.
We're talking to Martha Barnett from A Way With Words about family dialects, familects, those unique words and phrases that can happen within a family or maybe a other tight social group. And we're hoping to hear some of your examples at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ginny is with us now in Lancaster. Ginny, hello.
Hello.
You've got an example for us?
Hi, Ginny.
Yes. So in the mid to late 70s, I played on the women's basketball team at the UW. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, this word was developed, and we would say it meant like you're not doing anything. You're just being. And so, like, the word was cartonite. So if somebody asked you what you were doing, you'd say, I'm cartonizing. Or you're engaging in cartonization. I mean, it was just this random thing that we developed as a team. I guess it was a team luck kind of thing. Maybe.
Yeah, definitely. Now, Ginny, I want to ask, is this something that happened off the court? Or could you say something was cartonizing on the court? Like, yeah, you're out there, but you're not defending, you know, your assignment or whatever. You're cartonizing on the court.
I think we mainly tried to do it off the court.
Well, I hope
so. We wouldn't get in trouble. Yeah.
Ginny, thanks so much. I would bet sports teams are, you know, you're with these people a lot in very intense situations,
right.
Martha. That seems like a perfect environment for some of these word inventions.
Boy, it sure does. Yeah, any small close-knit group like that is going to develop their own shorthand, and it's much more efficient that way, but it can be so much fun. I mean, I'll bet that when she texts with her ex-teammates now, you know, they can still use that word and everybody knows what it means. It's sort of like this wonderful verbal photo album.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Ginny, at 800-642-1234. Well, I hope the Central Time team doesn't accuse me of cartonizing through the day now. Marcus is with us next in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So when my grandma was alive, she used to say that you really only needed three movies to understand life. That was White Christmas, It's a Wonderful Life and The Godfather. And so she used to quote to us pretty heavily out of those three movies. But two that stuck around is from White Christmas. Let's just say we're doing it for a pal in the army, you know, which is sometimes, let's just say it's for a pal in the army or just a pal. You know, it's like a tenuous connection where you're kind of obligated and you should do this, but you really don't want to. And so that's when he's pointing his fake arm and rubbing it. And then the other one from White Christmas that she used a lot and we still continue to use is snood. Meaning like a stash or a hoard of, you know, like if we were keeping chips in our room as children and as teenagers and we had them in Tupperware, all of a sudden we come down and we're eating Sun Chips. And my dad might look at us and be like, where'd you just pull those out of your snood? And it's like, it's a reserve that you probably shouldn't have or you should be more sharing with the rest of the family.
Okay, Marcus, I got to ask, one of those movies is an odd one out. Where did The Godfather come into it? Did Grandma make you an offer you can't refuse? Like, you're going to eat dinner or did you have to keep your friends close, your enemies closer? Where did that fit in?
Rob, I don't want to have to come with a signed check and Luca Brasi. That's all I got to say.
All right. Marcus, thank you so much. Now, this is another category, Martha. In a band I've been in for a long, many years, we could exist solely, I think, on certain movie references. Does this end up being part of our shared tight-knit language?
Oh, sure. You know, a family sits around watching TV night after night, and you just pick up different words and phrases. The one that's going around in our house is off you pup, which we'd never heard until we started watching the British baking show. And, you know, when they send the judges away for a little bit, they say off you pup. And now we just say that. And I think we're going to be using that for quite a while.
Marcus, thank you so much for sharing that story. We're talking to Martha Barnett, co-host of A Way with Words. We're looking at Familects, family dialects, the unique made-up languages or words and phrases that we share with our families or our basketball team or other tight-knit group of friends and colleagues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have one of these? Do you have many of these? Maybe one with your family, one with your coworkers, one with I don't know who. Love to hear some of your great examples and where they came from at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about Familects, the unique words and phrases we share with our families or other close relationships. Martha Barnett is with us, co-host of the radio show A Way with Words. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Want to hear your unique words in your family? You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or call 800-642-1234. Amanda is with us now in Watertown. Hi there, Amanda.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah, what is your word for us?
I've actually got two. They're words that my daughter couldn't say when she was growing up. She couldn't say you're welcome. She always said whack-em. And so we would say whack-em, whack-em, and that went well into her teens. And we would try to teach her to call our cat to her. So we'd say, come here. We do the kissy sound, and she'd go, meer. And she, again, it's one of those things that has just stuck with us. I mean, we just went and visited her a couple weeks ago in college, and we did it again, and always has the motions and the whole sound effects and everything.
All right, let's try it. Amanda, thank you for calling.
Whack-em, whack-em.
Also awesome. Thank you, Amanda, for that. Now, Martha, we had some of those, the kids couldn't pronounce a potty, so pot it was the word for a bathroom for a long time. Is this a pretty common, that kid mispronunciation, pretty common source of these Familect words?
Calls about those all the time. And they're just, you know, they're just so precious. It's just a little picture of your child when they were very small. And as Amanda said, these things stick around for a lifetime often. And, you know, she mentioned cats, and I was thinking that another example of this kind of thing is the names of our pets. They often evolve. You know, you give the pet a name like we heard from a listener who first called their pet their cat orange juice. And then eventually the cat's name was Lanny because it went from orange juice to foos to poos to pusillanimous to Lanny Mouse and then to Lanny. And these are things that the family shared and nobody else did. And that's what's so precious about it.
I wonder if the cat was cool with all of that. I don't know. Hard to tell, though.
If there's food involved, I think they'd be okay.
Yeah. Do we see that kind of evolution in the words within a family very often? Because I think I can think of examples like that in my own family where it started as one thing and then 3 years later, it's been through 20 steps and it's something completely different.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think that's often the case.
Thanks for your call, Amanda. Mark joins us now in Menominee. Mark, what did you want to share with us?
So when my oldest son was really young, he super loved Pringles, but he would only leave like one or two chips in the bottom of it. And so the phrase, "you Pringled that," came about. And so now whenever there's anything with like one or two things left, even today, it's like, dude, who Pringled the cheese? Who Pringled the chip?
I am totally stealing that. That is fantastic.
Yeah, Mark.
I'm guilty of that as well, Mark.
And you keep saying it now, Mark. Is this something you've said in front of other people, not family members, and they kind of do a double take?
We get all kinds of weird looks. It happens, you know, at the restaurant. It happens at other people's houses. Yeah, of course.
Thanks a lot. That is a great one, Mark. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Martha, I mean, do we think it happens sometimes that word might start at the family or local group level, but somehow goes viral, even maybe before the internet, and starts to spread into the language?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, expressions like FHB, I don't know if your family ever used that. I think early on that was pretty localized for family hold back. You know, if you have guests over and you want to kind of give a subtle message to everybody around the table that they shouldn't take food so that the guests can have enough.
FHB.
FHB or FLO, flow, family layoff. They're little things that family members can say to each other and other people don't get it. You know, sort of like that look when you're invited to somebody's house and maybe you do something to catch your partner's eye and tell him you want to go.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jean is with us now in Madison. Jean, hi.
Hi. I'm calling about boogeyman names.
Oh.
Now, do you have unique ones in your family, Jean?
Well, I grew up outside of Fond du Lac in a neighborhood where we sort of ran wild in the 60s and 70s, and we had a boogeyman named Butchum Birium Beer.
And I did you make no that idea. Name up?
Well, I don't know. I was kind of the youngest of the group, so I thought, do other people call the boogeyman that? But I've never seen it written. So it's
weird.
It was fun, but I still think about him.
Interesting. I'm a little scared now. Gene, thanks for calling in. I never thought about that, Martha. Do different parts of the country or maybe even different families have their own versions of the boogeyman or boogeymen?
Oh, there are so many boogeyman words. I mean, I'm thinking in the South, sometimes there's a reference to the Willipus Wallopus, which is this multi-legged creature that will come and get the bad children. Or Snollygoster is another one that haunts, the countryside looking for children who have misbehaved. Parents have been coming up with those words for a long time, and sometimes they're widespread, but I could see, a mom or dad coming up with a word themselves to keep those kids in line.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Martha Barnett from A Way with Words, looking at those words and phrases unique to maybe one family or one group of close friends. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Sharon joins us now in Appleton. Sharon, what do you have for us?
Hi there. I have a contraction mess up that my boys did when they were little. 18 months apart, they kind of learned to talk together. And when they were saying, "I am not," instead of saying, "I'm not," they'd say, "I am'n't." "No, I am'n't." And it was just their way of saying it. They're teenagers now, and it still slips out.
Fantastic,
no,
Sharon.
No, I am it.
I am it. And Martha, I love this one because it by the rules of contractions, it should work, right? Are not, aren't, am not, why not, amn't?
Right. And I think you will find that in some dictionaries, amn't.
Thanks. And of course, I mean, the way that the English language has solved it informally is to go with ain't, Martha. Somebody started that at one point, right?
Yes. That ain't has been around for a very, very long time, and it doesn't bother me at all. I'm thinking this reminds me also of we've had several calls from parents whose kids are told to behave, and the kids will say, I am being have. they're misunderstanding the word, and I just love those misunderstandings that end up being things that last forever in a family.
Sharon, thanks for calling. I am it. Sorry that you called. Kay joins us next in Madison. Kay, hello.
Yes, two things. We had a dog that we called Skippy, because he was like peanut butter colored. And my sister broke her arm several times, and so she always had casts on her arms. And she also had smelly feet, and we would just tell her that it was Mr. Stinky or Mr. Smell.
Okay.
what her body was smelling like.
Oh, no. How did she feel about that, Kay?
Well, I was older, so I thought that was a good thing. They didn't call me that. We called it to her.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. And Martha, I'm guessing hopefully a good-natured ribbing among siblings can lead to words and phrases that catch on within a family.
Sure. That one sounds, sometimes people do go by the name, especially in certain parts of the country, people will go by a name like Stinky for a long time.
I don't aspire to that. Kay, thanks a lot for the call. Jill is with us now in Rice Lake. Jill, hi.
Hi. Hold on. I have two things. My oldest son, when he was little, could not say these things. And he said them so cute that we still use it today. And one is grinkle, grinkle, little doll.
Instead of twinkle, twinkle, right?
I think we got that one, yeah.
Yeah. And ecrebity hoke.
Ecrebity, like Incredible Hulk. Oh, okay, so that's kind of like the spaghetti paschetti sort of thing. But Jill, you say you've kept singing, what is it, Grinkle Grinkle over the years?
Grinkle Grinkle Little Doll is the way we've taught it to grandchildren. And Ecrebity Hulk, that's just who he is.
Excellent, Jill. Oh, so that's another one in our category of mispronunciations that become the accepted pronunciation, Martha.
Yeah, and you know, this is reminding me of an email that we got years ago from a listener who and I would suggest this for your listeners. She compiled a 33-page document of all of these family sayings and words when the kids were growing up in the 1950s and 60s. And it's just this thing that the whole family treasures now. You know, one of the kids misunderstood New Mexico as new mixing bowls. So they would talk about wanting to go to New Mixing Bowl, or they referred to the newscaster, Walter Cronkite, as Waffle Cornflake. And these things, you know, or a Post-it note as a Peely Deely. And it, again, it's like a family photo album. It's a really, I think, great exercise.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Susie is with us in New Berlin. Susie, what's your example?
Hi. When my daughter was, about five, we were playing school. She was the teacher. I was the student. I did a picture or something for her. And then a little while later, she said, Mama, how do you make, what letter makes the J sound? And I said, well, it could be a G or a J. What are you doing? No, nothing. And then she handed me my picture back with a grade on the top. And it said, good gob.
And did you stick with that, Susie? Good gob?
Well, we still say it. And she's like a lead nurse in Milwaukee Hospital now. And she occasionally will commend her other nurses when they do something quality. Good gob. And I had to explain to them what it was, because they thought, what? You know.
Oh, that's a great example, Susie. Thank you so much. Martha, just a few moments left. You collect these kind of things at Away With Words, right? People can go to your website and share their unique words with you?
Absolutely. Yeah. waywardradio.org. You can mail it to us at words@waywardradio.org. We'd love to hear more about these. The list goes on and on. I don't think we've Pringled this yet.
Oh, you did a good job today, Martha. Thanks for joining us.
It was great to be here. Thanks.
It's Martha Barnett, co-host of A Way with Words. You can hear that here on the Ideas Network Sunday mornings at 9. You can keep sharing your unique words and phrases you share with your family and close friends on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, Wisconsin is one of just 3 states that automatically tries 17-year-old defendants as adults. We'll look at how that affects future incidents of crime and society as a whole. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.